Ontario Public Service Employee Union, and one of the coordinators of Labour for Palestine Ottawa chapter. Here are Alla and Gabby in conversation. Take a listen.
Hi, so thank you so much for joining us on Rebel Radio today. To get started, can you give a bit of background on what Labour for Palestine is for those who maybe haven't heard of it?
Thank you very much first. Labour for Palestine is a network of union and labour activists across Canada that organized within our unions and our workplaces to get support for Palestine and for the Palestinian people and to speak about the rights of the Palestinian people and have educationals and participate in activities and advocate for the rights of Palestinian people and the right of return for the Palestinian people according to the UN Resolution 194. And we are a network across Canada.
And so tell me what inspired you personally to get involved with Labour for Palestine.
So first thing, I am Palestinian-Canadian, born and raised in the West Bank. So I grew up throughout the first Intifada. You know, I was about 10 years old when it actually broke. I lived through part of the second Intifada. I was involved in student movements in Palestine and labor organization also during my grad school in the U.S. And I was already a union steward and very involved in labor work here. So advocating for the rights of my people, for Palestinians, is part of what we do as Palestinians. It's something that I have to do. I'm already involved in the labor movement. So combining those two things together is just something natural. It's nice to do that in Canada. In addition, lots of the Palestinian resistance to the Israeli apartheid system and to the occupation, even before the first Intifada, has started through students' unions, through labor unions, through all sorts of unions that were there that organized through all sorts of different forms of resistance and strikes that, you know, in the 70s and 80s and before. You can even trace that back to the 30s. So it's natural in our blood as Palestinians, as Palestinian labor activists. So I happen to be now Palestinian-Canadian, been here for a while and involved. It's just the natural thing for me to do.
And that's interesting what you were talking about the role of student and labor unions in the Intifada. To build on that, you know, obviously the power from organized labor comes from the fact that workers create the value of a company or whatever workplace they're working for. How does student organizing consolidate power, and what kind of power is it that they are consolidating?
That's a great question that you ask. So student power, first thing, you have a few things. This is it comes sometimes to the first involvement in students when they're in colleges in actual real organization, because they have association and they have elected officials. They have elected officials there. They are going to be, you know, the next workers. They're going to be the next doctors, the next engineers, the next technicians, the next lawyers, the next workers who are out there, and they're going to be organizing in unions. So the first step is there, and their job is usually to organize and to stand up for students' rights against university administration, do the best for them, and organize there. This is very powerful. So it's when you organize throughout a labor movement, and that's, as I said, it's reflected, starts with a student movement, you have space to actually talk to people. You have people with a common cause together to do. You have a platform for elected officials across the board of that space. As I said, during the Israeli occupation, even, let's see, if we just take from 1967 on, the Palestinian universities were the actual hub with a lot of that organization and resistance against the Israeli apartheid and occupation started. Because other than that, universities are a place of intellect. They're a place where ideas of progressiveness, of liberation can go. So all the different Palestinian parties would actually run for the student union. The student union would also be involved in educating people about the resistance, about the apartheid, and participating in the legal resistance against occupation. Usually the student union leaders, you look in the 70s and 80s and before, in all Palestinian universities, they will be elected one day and then be arrested the next day, because the occupation authority knew that this is a problem because you have enlightened progressive people who actually won an election and they're willing to organize. The other thing about students, they have the energy and the open mind to go, and there might be more risk-taking than some adults, actually.
That makes sense. So it sounds like there's a vigor in students as well, the intellect, like you were talking about. You're building this consciousness for future workers. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Vigor and consciousness for student workers. You'll find a lot of labor unions and activists. If you take a look at their bios, many of them actually have started during their student days. So this is what we're actually seeing right now in the universities, you know, across the United States, Canada, UK, and many parts of Europe around the world. This is what started in Columbia universities, because you have that vigor. You also have that exposure for intellect, and there is the desire to change. Even looking at a different issue in the 60s, was a lot of the resistance in the U.S. for their horrible invasion of Vietnam. Lots of that movement also started through universities, because, you know, when you're a student in university, you also still don't have those shackles that are at you, that maybe you have an employer that is putting there.
That makes sense. So it sounds like at the end of the day, student unions are unions, and they have the power to build this collective strength. Kind of in that topic then, we've been seeing, you mentioned the encampments across the U.S. and Canada, and we've been seeing bargaining happening between the leaders of these encampments and university administration. And so I was wondering, what are your thoughts on how bargaining has been going, especially as a labor activist as well, who has been exposed to this process? What do you make of the bargaining that's been going on?
It is very typical of, you know, an employer who's holding back, who wants to lock employees, and an employee union who is fighting for the fair rights of the employers. So taking examples of, we take a look at any major strikes, you find that the union had organized for a strike, and then they held their work, and then they went to a picket line going on and on and on to try to put pressure on the employer, who usually holds back. And things could keep going until either the employer bulges or some other pressure is put there. Let's take a look at what the student did. They are fighting for a just and right cause, because they do not want their universities to be involved in an occupation and apartheid, and supporting an occupation and apartheid government and the genocide. So they want the list of companies that the universities need to actually divest from, disclose, then divest. So the students presented their demands the same way that you have a bargaining team will present their demands to an employer. And they also drew power action in their hands, similar to a picket line. What the students were doing there in terms of protesting there, same thing when you have a picket line, you stand there and you go across and you keep going and you show your flags, you show your support, and you pass flyers. This is what students did. Both are also a peaceful form of rightful protest. And seeing how the different universities have dealt with that is similar to how many employers. You saw that the Ontario Tech decided to disclose and divest. There was progress, I think, at the Toronto Metropolitan Universities, while some others like McGill and University of Toronto are showing a hard line. If I take a look at it, I take a look at our, let's say, college sector in OPSU, where we actually had a five-week strike 7 years ago and went to arbitration. We ended up actually making progress on our demand. A few years ago, we did work to rule, and the employer backed off, and we went to an arbitration. Well, we see a bit of a standoff now with the LCBO, workers. You know, where they voted a 97% strike, but the employer wants to lock them out. So the aggressive reaction of an employer towards union organization varies. Sometimes depends how much, you know, who's there on the employer side. Do they actually understand the bargaining process? Do they actually have any sense of giving rights to the workers the same way? Do they understand These universities are actually investing in genocide, investing in companies that are supporting genocide and apartheid. Are they actually willing to listen to the public? And what we have been seeing is, you know, the students make their demands, they talk to the university, they tell them something back, and they go back again. And then some of these universities use different tactics to scare off the students, such as trying to, you know, contact the police or threatening them with this or that, or they have been more agreeable. So it's the same sort of organization. It's very comparable, and the process is also very comparable. And you can see, for instance, there's workers who are trying to organize as a union, and the employer was against it. They would hit very hard on that.
I'm interested, you mentioned like OPSU going to arbitration in the past. And from what I understand, students don't necessarily have these same types of avenues when they hit an impasse in bargaining. We've heard, for example, the local university here in Ottawa, I've heard that they've reached an impasse in bargaining. They haven't been getting responses from the administration, and they expect trespass notices soon. And so I guess I'm wondering, how can labor provide that support where their bargaining processes have these kind of mechanisms that can push the bargaining process forward?
Unfortunately, since it's not a process governed by labor laws, the arbitrator here should be, you know, the court of public opinion, the court of public opinion on right and wrong, the court of public opinion on standing up for human rights. So at this point, the student need all the support that they can from labor movements across the board. And, you know, Laura Walton of Ontario Federation of Labor spoke. Also, I can mention that a few weeks ago, when the University of Toronto put an injunction against the students, many officials from unions, including from QB and OPSU President J.P., Hornick, went in support to the University of Toronto, and USW, United Steelworkers, and OPSU has sought an intervener status in the injunction, the court injunction against the University of Toronto. So you need action, and action on the ground from unions, either to support the public opinion by having campaigns to do that, and also, you know, having standing with the students in the ground the same way that people go in demonstrations, also educating people about the issue. And whenever there is a legal need, they need the support, because there's no arbitrator. Things go to court. They need all the support that they can. In my opinion, you know, if any university actually did not invest in let's say companies that support apartheid and genocide, then we disclose from day one. And universities and colleges are places of learning and places of intellect and places where people should advocate the anti-war perspective. So it is imperative that all these universities and colleges do not invest in any entities that actually support occupation, apartheid, and genocide. And that's, of course, is very clearly is the state of Israel right now. That should be a no-brainer, should be, I would believe, in every university principal that is there. I'm actually, you know, sometimes a little bit shocked from the resistance from the universities just to even disclose, which, you know, puts a lot of questions on why don't they want to disclose where their investments are.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It is alarming, the resistance to even disclose it. It does raise a lot of questions. And you mentioned, you know, a way that we can win this disclosure in other ways is for, you know, the labor movement to launch campaigns to show their support. And I'm wondering, you know, how are the struggles of the Palestinian people and the workers of the world connected? How is Palestine a labor issue?
Very good question. So I'm going to start from two things. First, all Palestinians live under one form or occupation or another, or they're actually, many of them are refugees. So speak quickly about where are Palestinians right now. So in 1948, or between 1947 to 1949, over 500 Palestinian villages were destroyed, and many Palestinians were actually pushed out of the land of Palestine. So right now we have about 7 million, 6.8 to 7 million Palestinian registered refugees, as a few are non-registered. Those are mostly in refugee camps in Gaza, which is mostly refugees, and in Lebanon, Syria, and some of the West Bank, Jordan, and Egypt. Well, after what happened in 1948, there was still about some Palestinians who left there, and those now become inside the 1948 borders of the ethno-racial entity known as the State of Israel. There's about 2 million Palestinians, and there's about 3.5, 3.7 million Palestinians in the West Bank. And there's a group also about, you know, we know about 2.5 million in Gaza, and about, you know, another 5 million or more outside there are refugees. So let's speak about every group and how actually every group has suffered. First thing, many of the Palestinians who have been deported and forcefully removed from 1948, they lost their agricultural land. They lost their places of work. They lost everything. So there was a lot of the Palestinians has been converted in Gaza and the West Bank into cheap labor to work inside Israel, because lots of their agricultural land is gone. There's no infrastructure for a state for anything. So they do these construction jobs and cleaning jobs and these low-level jobs that are there. Most of them are not unionized, and they have to get, and they work under horrible conditions, and they have to take to get a work permit. So that's the one side, and they're all suffering. The second thing is all Palestinian workers are suffering under occupation. The West Bank is 248 separate islands. Gaza is the largest open air prison. Even before the bombing started, there is apartheid discrimination also against the Palestinians in the West, inside what's known as Israel. So all of those don't have the rights of free movement. They're all suffering from a wage disparity, a rights disparity with the Jewish Israeli workers. That's number one. Number two is also what I spoke there, is lots of the resistance of the Palestinian people has started, especially the peaceful form of resistance in forms of strikes, in forms of withholding work, has started even from 1936. It was one of the longest histories, one of the longest strikes in history against the British occupation, which lasted over 6 months. During the first Intifada, general strikes were actually organized by unions and also by workers when we were under full military occupation to close everything. And the Israelis would come to try to open things by force because we were withholding our work. And the Palestinian unions realized that this is, you know, a very powerful way of actually resisting Israel, is doing resisting occupation, is by organizing through our work and strikes. And that's where on July 9th, 2005, there was a historic moment of collective consciousness for many Palestinians, with lots of Palestinian unions and Palestinian community organization came together and made the call for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. So all of that came from Palestinian unions. So when we get involved in boycott, divestments, and sanctions against Israel, we're acting on the call of the Palestinian workers' unions, and we're acting with the call for a peaceful way to resist the Israeli occupation. Now, let's link that to the last system other than Palestine, which had an apartheid by a colonial power that was very similar, South Africa. So South Africa, the South African system created the Bantustan system. And for those who are not familiar, the Bantustan is these areas where the black people of South Africa, each called, one of them called a home nation, was allowed only to be there if they needed to work. They needed a work permit. They needed, and they needed to move. This is similar to what's happening to the West, to the Palestinians, with 248 islands in the West Bank and the closed thing in the Gaza Strip. So whatever you needed to go in South Africa outside of those, you needed a permit and you were subjected to the oppression of the apartheid. Same thing that we have in the West Bank. You want to go from one piece to another, you have a checkpoint. You need a permit. You need a permit to do this. It's impossible for you, let's say, to be in Nablus and go work in Ramallah right now with the occupation, even though it's about a 45-minute drive. It could take you 2 or 3 hours. My point is, the one of the ways that the apartheid system in South Africa fell down was the boycott, divestment, and sanction, the SACTU movement. And that SACTU movement that started in the 80s, it started by unions and labor organizations, then government support. In Canada, that was started by unions. Unions said, no, we will boycott South Africa. We're not getting any products from there. We're not buying South African wine. Then governments followed after that. There's one more point I'll make. Right now, most of the unions here in Canada and elsewhere, unions are not just a place for rank and file issues. They are also political. Many union steward and union officer oaths also hold the union steward and official to act against anti-indigenous, anti-black, and all forms of racism. In our OPSU steward oath and officer oath has that, and many of them, ask you to also stand up for human rights. Supporting workers elsewhere is something that we always do, There was the issue of the workers in Colombia with the mines, and this is why OPSU does not use or buy any of the Coca-Cola products anymore. Worker issues are worker issues everywhere around the world, and unions and labor activists must also stand up for human rights, whatever that is. You can't be, championing your worker rights here. Well, maybe your union actually has some investment in an oppressive system that oppresses workers and engages in apartheid.
It really highlights, I guess, the international solidarity, like power, bringing more power to workers anywhere in the world will support the cause of workers everywhere in the world. Thank you again so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Thank you very much.
That was Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and Ala Kuti from Labor for Palestine in conversation. To learn more about and to donate to Labor for Palestine's Defense Fund, please visit the link in our show notes, or for all of you listening on radio, please visit rabble.ca. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, Monday marked Canada Day across the nation, and on Rabble, columnist Aaron Blondo reflected on Canada's complicity in genocide. From the time of its creation and for more than a century after, Canada perpetrated a genocide against the Indigenous peoples living within its borders. In 2024, Canada remains complicit in genocide, as it continues to support Israel's government as it kills Palestinian civilians and displaces them from their land. Blondo writes, quote, "Every Canada Day is a day of reflection for me, as a Métis person with British-Ukrainian ancestry, about what decolonization looks like in the contemporary context. This year, however, my reflections are more international, while I face what it means to be complicit in a genocide." End quote. Also this week, in Canadian politics, John Price and Midori Ogasawara shared part one of a three-part series on Canada's emerging national security state. Bill C-70 was recently rushed through Parliament, which expands the spying and police powers of Canada's national security agencies. Among those criticizing the new law are the BC and Canadian Civil Liberties Associations, the Canadian Association of University Teachers, the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group, Amnesty International, the Canadian Muslim Public Affairs Council, and Independent Jewish Voices Canada. Of particular concern are the bill's impacts on freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, and on privacy, and it could well be used to profile people on political, racial, religious, or nationality grounds. Follow this series on rabble.ca. And finally, this week in labor news, a new report from the Immigrant Workers Center in Montreal is finding that many immigrants to Canada are facing financial hardship. According to the report, one in three immigrants to Canada are facing financial difficulties. For immigrants who've come to Canada since 2005, the rate of poverty rises to 43%. The Immigrant Workers Center states that Canadian corporations are responsible for some of the blame for migrant poverty, not just here at home, but around the world. A 2018 report to the Federal Standing Committee on Citizenship and Immigration found that Canadian corporations often overexploited resources in underdeveloped countries, leading to a greater push for residents of those countries to migrate. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we mentioned today on Rabble.ca.
In 2024, many indie news media organizations are making the hard decision to close up shop. But with your support, Rabble.ca can continue to share news for the rest of us for years to come. Support Rabble during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation. It's never too late to become a Rabble Rouser.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and now on YouTube. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to share Rabble Radio on your local radio station? It's easy. For more information, get in touch with me, Brianne Doyle, at brianne@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
The art of the mixtape is not lost.
Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.